Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Jake Cantor. On today's show, it's all change at the top of the sun with repercussions for the Sunday title and The Times. Our panel discuss that. Plus, Times Radio, that's happening. Disney Plus reveals impressive numbers, and so do the national radio stations. And in the media quiz, we discover the trends of yesteryear returning to our screens. It's all to come in today's Media Podcast. So with me today is a media writer, Maggie Brown. Maggie, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Very good to see you again. A quick tour of your Twitter suggests that you've had an interest in publishers increasing their audience by reducing the amount of content that they produce.
Yes, I noted that. I mean, The Guardian said, I think they cut their stories by a third.
Fascinating.
I found it fascinating because if you ask me, I'm reading actually more of it and I'm finding the daily editions almost as challenging as Sunday newspapers. So that had passed me by. That was why I tweeted about it.
Well, the perceived wisdom is more is more, isn't it?
But actually what it is that the things that really interest people are read properly, others are just discarded. And so there's a certain sort of interest in honing down an agenda. And that is also being supported by what they can now do, which is look at the digital operations, and it's a very accurate feedback.
Fantastic. Well, welcome. Also joining us is a broadcast consultant and the host of Radio Days Europe 2020. It's Paul Robinson.
Hi.
How are you, Paul?
Good, thank you. Good. Busy collecting air miles.
Yes, I was going to say, where have you been jet-setting this week?
I've come back from Russia. Come back from Russia, which is really interesting, actually. The market is really opening up, and they're investing very heavily in co-production and putting very significant tax incentives in place. So, yeah, Russia and then America next week. So that gets the contrast
and
going.
And can you tell us about your interview that you've told us off, Mike?
I could not possibly comment about that.
Okay, well, we'll move on swiftly then. It's all change at the top of the Sun newspaper, as Tony Gallagher makes way for Victoria Newton. Maggie, what do we know about Victoria?
Well, what we know is that, of course, she has already edited the Sun on Sunday. She's a very respected leader of the people there, especially the push into the digital versions of the Sun. And of course, she's a woman, which I think is very interesting. But you can't really divorce it from the changes that are taking place in Times media, newspapers as a whole, because clearly there have been changes. And they're really also related to a bigger issue, which is that in July, News got the go-ahead to actually use a fused editing team or journalists anyway across the papers of the Sundays, and in particular it was the Sunday Times and the Times. And so that's also resulted in the Martin Ivins stepping down.
And so we're seeing that being replicated at the
Sun. Yes, the Sunday Times, which Emma Tucker, is the new editor. She stepped up from being deputy editor, and she has a lot of experience in across the board, really, especially in digital. And so they are in the process of changing their operations and, in fact, cutting costs. That's the real bottom line as well, as well as becoming more digitally attuned, pushing the multimedia
stuff. And we're seeing a similar story at the Mirror this week. They're going 7 days a week, subsuming Sunday Mirror and the People into the wider newsroom. Are we seeing the quick death of Sunday newspapers here?
I don't know. I mean, I still like a Sunday newspaper. I must admit, it's something about a Sunday paper, isn't there?
Aren't they?
Yeah, they are, you know. And you know what you're getting. And I would miss that sort of thud on the doorstep in the morning, you know, when the Sunday paper arrives. I mean, on the issue of the editor, I can't possibly comment. What I do like about The Sun is it continues to surprise. And I was very happy on January 31st when the headline, of course, on The Sun was all about, oh, thank goodness, that's the end of dry January. That was very clever. I mean, those things I do appreciate The Sun for.
There's good humour in it. Yeah. I mean, one thing I don't actually like very much about the news, well, the Sunday Times, is they've got this biodegradable wrapping, and mine always gets dumped in front of my porch. And this Sunday, I had to dry it out on my underfloor heating heated kitchen because it was it had completely soaked through. So in some ways, I'm a bit of a dissatisfied.
You can't go back on the biodegradable wrapping. You need a better porch, Maggie. You need to put a bit of fence around it or something, or increase its size.
But I think that the one of the other aspects of this is that women now are really coming very much to the fore. Now Emma Tucker is a very formidable operator. I have actually even written for her once. I mean, she's very, very charming, but she's tough. She's got wide experience, and she's a former Financial Times trainee as well. So she's been a foreign correspondent. She's been around, and so I think she can cover most bases, to be honest. But no, we've got half of the national newspapers now already being run by
that can
women.
Only be
fantastic,
a good thing.
Yes.
I'm not saying I'm just saying it's a change of times. And of course, there were women editors in the 80s. Don't forget at the News of the World and at the Sunday Express, but it's interesting that it's all, sometimes change happens really fast. And maybe it's to do also with Rebecca Brooks, who's in charge really of the News UK's papers, and she's clearly a woman.
Yep. So let's stick with News UK. It appears that Times Radio is going to be a thing with ambitions of rivaling Radio 4. Stig Abel, no stranger to this podcast, is the launch director. We're waiting for the call, Stig. Paul, what's the strategy here?
Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? They're saying this is a rival for Radio 4, but I have to sort of question that because commercially, it's very difficult to rival Radio 4. I mean, its budget is about £72 million a year, and it invests in very expensive quality journalism, drama, investigative journalism, you know, a whole bunch of strands that actually are, you know, really strong public service content, great variety, very hard to make money on that. And I notice it says it's going to be opinion-led programming, which sounds a bit like it's similar to talk radio or Radio 5.
Well, I was going to say, what talk radio station isn't opinion?
Well, exactly. I mean, and what's it going to be? I mean, you know, to really rival Radio 4, you need built programming. You need, you know, programs which have got a budget, which have got researchers, they've got time, you know, and they can go away and do something meaningful. So I'm not sure how you're going to target. And it's interesting that Radio 4's latest radar figures are very strong. They've gained 500,000 listeners year on year. So Radio 4 is still in, you know, very, very robust health. I guess if they get maybe, you know, 10% or 20% of Radio 4's audience, that would be a significant audience for them. But they're never going to, I think certainly in the next 10 years, I can't see Radio 4 being overhauled by any commercial operator.
No, I agree. But on the other hand, there's a difference, isn't there? They have got a lot of journalists now who are doing podcasts and are actually quite reasonable. I'm not saying they're Radio 4 today's standard, but
journalists,
you know,
doing podcasts.
You know, indeed.
Shocking.
The other thing is really when you stand back, the previous attempts have not been very good. One previous attempt, Channel 4 tried to lead a radio consortium to actually fill up a whole digital multiplex. But
how did that go?
As we know, the star of the show is supposed to be a sort of challenge to Radio 4 and certainly to the Today programme.
And look, they hired Bob Shannon to run it, and he temporarily left the BBC to go and run it. So, you know, Bob's a good radio guy. He knows what he's doing, and he couldn't make it work. And then he got back to the BBC as quickly as he could.
Well, I mean, they had to pull it. I mean, it was decided, and it was partly, to be fair, sacrificed because of the downturn in 2008, and the decision to pull it actually arose from the collapse in advertising and the kind of sense of panic really that took place in September 2008, where they cut back staff, and that was the first project to go. I think they lost £8 or £9 million It's not a huge amount in terms of a £1 billion budget.
But do we think that times have changed? I mean,
I do think this is a
huge endorsement for the health of commercial radio, isn't it?
Sure, it is, if it works. I mean, what's more interesting, frankly, is if you look at the last year, Global have launched a whole series of brand extensions, and they've done amazingly. I mean, they've added 2 million listeners to these brand extensions, which are basically just recuts of existing music. So Heart 90s, Heart Dance, Capital Extra Reloaded, Smooth Radio Chill, Heart 70s, Smooth Radio Country. Basically no presenters, back-to-back music. You know, they're actually beating Spotify by doing this. That's how you make money in commercial radio. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult to sustain the right investment to genuinely rival Radio 4. They might get 500,000 listeners. They might get quite a nice audience that they can do something with. Interestingly, they're not going to have advertising, so they're going to do the same as Virgin Radio and do the sort of the sponsorship thing. But look, I think it could be an interesting player, but is it going to be a rival to Radio 4 in the scale of Radio 4? I don't think so.
What's really happened, Paul, I think, is that when you look back to the 90s, when there was this expansion of commercial radio, new franchises, a national commercial radio for the first time, it all kind of went very slowly. I remember a time when the BBC was really getting worried. Liz Forgan, running BBC Radio, was even saying, we don't want these quarterly radar figures telling us about audiences.
I was head of strategy radio at the time, yes.
You were getting worried. And then it all kind of went wrong. And partly, I think, because the then radio authority was chopping everything up into...
Well, they over-licensed. What they did is they over-licensed, and so what happened was commercial radio started cannibalising itself, which meant that individual stations couldn't make enough money, and so therefore they, you know, some went bust or they merged and consolidated, and they all merged towards Top 40, because Top 40 is what makes the most money. So, you know, the ambition to have all these specialist stations funded commercially never happened because the advertising model doesn't support it.
And, of course, LBC was messed around with so many times before it sort of finally came good. As we know, it's been a tragic story until quite recently. But suddenly, everything is going very right for both digital radio and commercial radio after all sorts of changes, some good, some bad, which have taken place. But there's certainly more choice for people. And I see the Times' move actually more in the direction of we are establishing ourselves as whatever we want to call it, a media...
A multimedia brand,
which is serious, which can take politics seriously. We do a lot of foreign affairs. They still do that. It's a very, very good paper, in my opinion. And even, you know, obits are done...
So it's a bit like Sky News.
Yes.
What Sky News did for Sky.
Yes.
If it showcases their journalism, that has to be...
It also, you know, allows people who, as we know, why are podcasts and these things so popular? It's because people are maybe going to the gym, they're cycling. You know, they want to hear things as they go along, as well as maybe reading a screen. And I think that is another opportunity to get your, if you like, your journalism and your views, but well-founded, well-argued views, across to people. And I think we've seen radio really change in the past, I'd say, 8 years.
One last thought on this, Paul. When the radios are published next year, what do they get?
They're going to get 300,000 listeners, weekly reach, 300,000.
We'll hold you to that.
Okay.
So changing frequencies a bit, we're going to talk Disney+. The service declared its first subscriber numbers, and they are good. Paul, how good?
Well, very good. I mean, just under 30 million, which is amazing. Now, they've done some very smart things. They've done a deal with Verizon in the US, so they've bundled the Disney service with Verizon subscribers. They're in the process of doing a deal here in the UK with Sky, so Disney Plus is going to sit on the Sky Q box alongside Netflix, and they've really been pushing it. I think it's a very impressive number. They were very smart, though. They did set a low retail price. I mean, you know, Netflix is such a powerful brand that it's sort of the price fixer. You can't really charge more than Netflix, and that's also the BBC's problem, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But Disney went for a lower price, you know, very strong offer. They've got a great catalogue, of course. They've really used all of their outreach, you know, to market it. So it's a respectable number because they were always going to be compared with Netflix. I mean, they always say, we don't want to be compared, you know, don't compare with 170 million of Netflix, but people will. And 30 million in the first few months is a very respectable number. The challenge, I think, Jake's going to be whether they can grow it because...
or keep that 30 million. I mean, it's going to be a significant amount of churn, I assume.
I think there won't be much churn at all. And the reason I say that is that the secret weapon in churn is kids' content. That's the thing that stops people churning. Yeah. That's why Netflix, Amazon, Apple, they're all investing in kids, because no one's going to upset their kids. You know, for £7 a month, are you going to have a riot in your household because you take Peppa Pig off? You're just not going to do it.
And children are very conservative. Once they've found a thing they like, they just watch it and watch it.
They stick with it.
So then the adults can't really move on to the other things they want on their TV, because the kids in the morning are going to get up and watch this program again. I see it all the time.
So I think the Disney service is going to be very sticky. I think it's not going to get much churn. I mean, obviously, when kids grow out of Disney, that would be the issue.
That's everyone's challenge.
But that's everyone's challenge.
Does anyone grow out of Disney? I mean, I still love Disney.
I don't, and I'm old. So I think it won't be stickiness. I think the issue for them is whether they can actually grow it, because they're not used to making the sort of volume Netflix is doing. I mean, Netflix is producing, you know, shed loads of volume, isn't it? And Disney's using a great library, but they're going to have to keep on adding and adding and adding. And the culture is, you know, every week you look and there's a new season or there's a new show. Mm. And can they do that? Because if they can't do that, they might find that they're going to sort of plateau.
But that's a culture bred
by
TV.
Sorry to interrupt you, Maggie. I just want to make that point.
We're used to new shows dropping every week. That's the TV diet that we have, isn't it?
Especially dramas these days. No, what I was going to say is something different. I was at a discussion on children's television a couple of weeks ago, and one of the interesting things that came up there was that the poor old UK children production companies are still saying, well, we've really still only got one big customer, and that's the BBC, unfortunately. And then another person said, yes, but look at what the Natural History Unit has done. It's made, you know, natural history into a global brand, and also all of the people, or the best people, have all been sort of pinched, really, or encouraged to go and make programmes in their own independent production companies for people like Netflix or whoever, National Geo. And so wouldn't it be wonderful if this happened to children's television, that we would find ourselves with not just Netflix, which is in it a bit, you know, taking all our rights, but we find ourselves in great demand, and that the British, you know, children's production side will just blossom. I'd love to hear your...
Disney Plus is already commissioning British production companies. Blick Films are making a natural history documentary, aren't they? And this can only be good for the community, can't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, Maggie. I mean, British writers and creators, particularly of preschool, are well revered around the world. I mean, we have got a good reputation, particularly for preschool. Yeah. You know, and what we're very good at
is Teletubbies is a classic one, isn't it?
Anne Wood and all that stuff, and Ragdoll, absolutely. And there's a long history of shows like that. But we're very good at design, we're very good at writing, very good at creativity. We're more expensive on physical animation. That's one of the problems, which often means that work might go out to Asia. Yeah. But I think the issue is more of a mindset, and it's, you just said it really, don't just make for the domestic platforms, make a British show that's got Britishness in it, but Britishness that translates to the rest of the world. And if you can do that, and you can sell it overseas, there's no reason why we can't be a real powerhouse of kids' production.
Okay, from Teletubbies to Downing Street. This week, journalists walked out of a briefing after some of them were sidelined. Can you tell us what happened, Maggie?
Well, it was simply that instead of the normal list of people who are in the lobby, there was an attempt to edit that list and have sheep and goats. And I'm very pleased to say that this was not on. The whole lobby, just all the people who were included, said, no, we're not going in. And so, you know, it didn't happen. So I think it's been, from that point of view, one of the nice or better pushbacks from the kind of rather sour and unpleasant atmosphere, which really stems from the general election, and all power to them.
So, I mean, it was a briefing with the Prime Minister's chief Brexit negotiator, David Frost. We think the BBC, ITV and The Guardian and the Financial Times were being allowed in. Some of those being barred were The Mirror, I and Independent.
Yes.
Which, I don't know, I mean, could you read into the political leanings of those particular titles? And
it sounds
suggest
fairly
that
Downing transparent to me.
Yeah. But, I mean... Do you think the...
Well, I mean, they were wrong. I mean, there's an established system of operating the lobby, like it or not, happens twice a day. I remember actually being on The Independent when it launched, and there was a debate about whether we went in the lobby or not. And, you know, high-mindedly, we said, oh, well, you don't really need them. But, of course, everybody does, really. So it's quaint, but it sort of works. But the real point is that journalists have reached a sort of... how can I put it? A breaking point, I think, with government attempts to both either not hold briefings at all, not include them on, you know, lists for where there are going to be speeches made, all the rest of it, not allowing questions. We've seen all of these things happening, not going on key programmes as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, does it speak to all those kind of
I think it speaks to a general sense of both frustration and pushing back. And it was clear, it was a feeling that, or a view that went across the whole board, regardless of who you were, the Telegraph as much as the Guardian. So I found that a very positive thing. And this is going to happen more and more, because you can't really run any kind of democracy in this way. And the press is a key part of that, and so are the broadcasters. So.
There is precedent here, of course. I remember this happening to me, actually. I was told I was not acceptable when I was working for a certain organisation. And I'm going back to the days before Tony Blair was elected, when Peter Mandelson was assembling New Labour. And New Labour were incredibly controlling in terms of who they allowed in. And I was actually at Talk Radio. I was the chief executive of Talk Radio, owned by CLT UFA, Franco-German company. And we were told we did not have passes, we were not allowed access into the party conference where the BBC was, because we weren't appropriate and we weren't the right political colour, and we were ejected from the room. We weren't allowed in. And Peter Mandelson then actually became a guest presenter on Talk Radio, and he was absolutely clear that his agenda was to make sure that New Labour only spoke to the journalists who are going to give New Labour a good coverage.
So this isn't just an insidious right wing agenda.
I don't think so. I think it happens in both parties, and I think, you know, whenever you've got maybe, he didn't have a majority thing, because it was before they were actually in power. Mm. But, you know, the Mandelson-Blair axis was incredibly strong at controlling, wasn't it? Labour, are you on message? That was the thing we kept on hearing.
But Mandelson spent his time going out to Sky News, I seem to remember.
He did.
In the 90s. I used to see him all the time when I was doing newspaper reviews.
I think he maybe was shopping at Tesco or something in Austerlitz.
And just to pick up on the point that Maggie made around ministers boycotting the Today Show, it appears maybe that those
Nicky Morgan
those,
didn't
yeah, I was going to say those hostilities may have ended with Nicky Morgan going on the Today programme, albeit not live in the studio. She was, I think, recorded at her speech at the Policy Exchange yesterday. But what do we make of that as an issue?
Well, I mean, look, I think given the size of the Today audience, and we're talking about 8 million people listening, I mean, it's an incredibly large audience. I mean, there's probably nowhere else in the morning you can get that sort of reach on any medium at all. So
it's the biggest news programme in the country.
So if you can make that work for you, then you should be on there. I think, you know, if you're going to go on the Today programme, you've got to be prepared, you've got to have your ducks in a row, and you've got to go for it. And I think any senior politician should be willing to do that. That's part of the job, I think.
It's interesting, though, that the ratings went up in the last quarter, despite the fact that there weren't any cabinet ministers or any kind of...
They did. I mean, you know, Radio 5 Live, Talk Radio, Radio 4, they all increased their audiences. So there was interest in the general election, despite, say, the absence of the big names.
Mm. So do we think that we're going to see declines now that the Brexit bump's over?
Well, I mean, it's a year-on-year thing, so we're not going to know. I suspect, you know, we're probably going to see a bit of a fallback in the speech stations next quarter. But, I mean, you know, 4% or 5% maybe, not catastrophic, but there'll be some decline, yes.
Okay. We'll be back with more media news right after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Spiritland Studios are run by Spiritland Productions, providers of professional audio solutions for TV, radio, and online. As well as their broadcast standard studio facilities, Spiritland Productions also has a world-class OB vehicle for audio and video projects of any scale. Whether it's podcasting, outside broadcasting, or live concert recording, produce your next show with Spiritland Productions. Go to spiritlandproductions.com now. Welcome back to the Media Podcast. And now, with the time coming up to 1:30, it's over to Paul Robinson with the Rajars.
Nobody gives a time check like that. Come on, Jake. What radio station are you listening to?
I didn't write this script.
Okay. Exactly. You just read it. I know. Well, the Rajars are very interesting because this is actually, as Maggie was saying earlier, this is actually about digital, because digital listening share has increased by 11%. So a new record. So digital listening is now 58.5% of all listening. So digital is now, you know, way ahead of analog. And it was boosted by several things. DAB continues to grow. I mean, DAB is still the single largest source of digital listening, but also there's growth in listening via smart speakers. Now, it's a huge growth, but still a relatively small number. 31% of adults now claim to have a voice-activated speaker, and 2/3 of those listen to radio on that speaker.
That's a great stat.
Yeah. And so the growth year on year is 43% in terms of total hours, but it still only represents 2.5% of total listening. But, you know, it's clearly growing. The other thing that's really interesting is digital radio in cars. Mm. Now they've finally got DAB sets as standard in cars. You're seeing real growth in listening in cars, up by 16% year on year. So really, really strong. And then, you know, people like stations like BBC Six Music, Radio 4 Extra, doing incredibly well, plus all the global stations doing very well. Chris Evans is interesting because Virgin Radio had this huge increase in audience, and it just hasn't continued. I mean, Chris Evans does have the single largest digital-only radio.
I was going to say, this is what Radio Today reported, isn't it?
But it's only 1.2 million people, you know, which you think, compared to Radio 2's breakfast show, where he came from, is tiny. So even Chris, you know, can't shift the numbers beyond that. And he's brilliant at bringing in audiences everywhere he goes, Radio 1, Radio 2. He's all Virgin. He's always added numbers. So really, it's about digital. And aside from that, bits of ups and downs. Zoe Ball's
she's
regained,
up, isn't she?
She's down on where she was. I mean, she's down on what she inherited, but she's up a bit on last time. So year on year, she's lost about 800,000 listeners, but it's not as bad as it was. But it doesn't look like she's ever going to get back to Chris Evans.
And what about Greg James? Because, I mean, his show is so heavily plugged across all of the BBC these days. He was slightly down, if I remember correctly.
Greg James is slightly down. He's down from 5.1 million to 4.8 million, but Radio 1 is down as well. I mean, Radio 1 is showing decline. And this is all part of the transition amongst young audiences away from linear. You know, they're moving to podcasts, they're moving to on-demand, and that's the big issue. So Radio 1 is sliding. Greg James' share of total Radio 1 audience has gone up, but he can't hold the whole station because it's a trend that's going in that direction. Capital's got the same problem. You know, this issue about younger audiences and how they're listening is becoming very, very significant.
Well, are we anywhere near, switch off of analog, in your view?
Well, FM is still getting about 40% of total listening. AM is now really, really small. So, I mean, AM stations are being switched off. And in fact, the BBC switched off the AM transmitters of quite a few of its local stations only in the last few weeks, and more to come. So AM is definitely gone. FM's going to be around for a while because you've got to replace those sets and they have a long lifetime. So, no, I think we're at least 5 years away, I would say.
We'll stick with your thoughts about the push for young viewers, or the push to retain young viewers anyway, and that's very much a BBC-wide issue. And one of the things they're trying to do to help increase their young audience is move Top Gear to BBC One. Maggie, do you want to tell us a bit about this?
Well, listen, I'm not really the expert on Top Gear, I can tell you, but it's pretty obvious, isn't it, that they've found suddenly that they've got the right lineup of presenters. The programme is just resonating with every kind of man I know anyway. And it's
they're
it's
saying more women are watching as
yes,
well.
Yes, they have changed it. But also the key thing surely is that the bar for what was a BBC One programme has lowered considerably. So 3 million or so is just brilliant. So it's an obvious move. And I'm surprised it's taken so long in a way, actually.
Well, I mean, the suggestion is that Jeremy Clarkson and Andy Willman, who used to obviously run the show, were always very reluctant on moving to BBC One because they like to be the top dogs on BBC Two.
Exactly, yes.
But also you have got this kind of revitalisation, haven't you?
Yeah, look, I think it's a smart move, and I agree with Maggie. I'm surprised it hasn't happened before. I mean, the strategic issue for the BBC is that to protect the licence fee, it has to have universality of access, and BBC One always used to be viewed by basically everybody. So it was easy. If, you know, BBC One was doing well, the BBC could argue licence fee, no problem, universality. But BBC One is starting to lose reach. It's not got the same universality. They've got to prop up BBC One. They cannot afford it. They could even allow a bit of loss on the other channels if BBC One is strong. So I think we're going to see increasingly more and more energy and more budget directed at BBC One. So
I agree. I think you're absolutely right. It's absolutely the mothership. And they've always had a quite ruthless policy, as we all know, of moving BBC Two hits over to BBC One. And that's why when you have a very strong overall director of television, which is what you do have at the BBC now, they will do everything they can now.
She's Charlotte Moore.
Yeah, Charlotte Moore, yes. Yeah. I mean, she's really, you know, the queen now. And they'll do anything to keep BBC One going.
Yeah.
And that's the key priority.
And I think we'll see other things moving too. I think this is not the only example. There'll be more to come, I'm sure. It's interesting, the RuPaul thing on BBC Three. I haven't seen any data on whether that worked. You know, there was definitely a move, wasn't there, to put, you know, RuPaul on to drive young audiences to BBC Three. I haven't seen...
The BBC will tell you it was a huge success.
Of course they will, but have you seen...
I mean, it did. I mean, it racked up millions and millions of views. I forget the precise number off the top of my head.
But were they the right people? I mean, because I was watching it and I'm clearly not the target audience.
The BBC said that they were young, that it was young audiences coming to it, and... Okay. It certainly helped towards what was a record year for iPlayer last year. They had 4 billion requests across the year, which is, just an extraordinary number. I think the BBC, you know, credit where it's due on that, I think.
Absolutely.
So we'll stick with the BBC. We've talked about something nice. Now we're talking something a bit more grim. And that was that we witnessed BBC News reporters live tweeting the prospect of redundancies across BBC News. 450 jobs are going. Maggie, tell us a bit more about this.
Well, the BBC, as we know, is facing cuts because it's not going to be compensated for the free over 75 licences, and they do face a crisis of quite considerable proportions, and it's happening right now. They have decided they need to cut 80 million out of the budget for news, and this is sort of one of the first ways of doing it. On the other hand, unless I've got the figure wrong, but the Financial Times put what I think was the right figure, that there's supposed to be about 6,000 people working on various news and current affairs related programming at the BBC. That is a huge number of
people. I think it's about 6,000.
Yes, and so
maybe just
That I always feel you need to put in context a cut like that. It is clearly of great concern to the people affected, and I do sympathise with especially the journalists who have been rooting around and getting very good social issue news stories on the Victoria Derbyshire show, which I think was a misplaced programme because it's in the morning. I never used to watch it, but I knew somebody who used to work on it, who's produced some fantastic journalism for Victoria to head up. So there are lots of concerns about this. On the other hand, we recently discussed whether people are doing too much news or doing too many news stories in newspapers, and what you really have to refine down your output on. And it could well be that this cut will not be as draconian as it seems to be to the people concerned. The worry is that things become homogenised. I think that that's one of the things that would concern me, that you have this massive newsroom, although hopefully they're going to send more people. They're supposed to be sending another contingency out to the regions. And we all know, if you watch the BBC carefully, which I do, you very often get the story of the day, which somehow goes on and on in the same vein all the way across different outlets until it almost drives you mad. And then it turns up on Newsnight as well. And I think that there does need to be some if they're going to rationalise and just decide almost centrally what are the big stories, then you could end up losing quite a lot of the variety and the quirks that you actually need to keep all these different audiences interested and informed.
Each bulletin has its personality, I guess, doesn't it?
I mean, I have had a problem in Newsnight recently because very often you turn to it and it's kind of repeating what you've been hearing maybe on the main news. And I think it does need to be maybe have a new identity and decide, you know, what it is about. And it could be that when you actually challenge an organisation, the organisation comes back, or the news output changes, but in a good way, not necessarily in a bad way, because you shake things up a bit. I don't know. But it is obviously all part of these cutbacks that are taking place at the BBC. And News and Current Affairs is their key public service, unique selling point. They do more of it than anybody else, and they do a lot of foreign news, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and in all different varieties. So we should be worried. I'm not saying it's an inconsiderable cut, but I'm saying that it may not be, you know, Armageddon.
Okay. I mean, let's just broaden this debate out a little bit. And I mean, it all plays the narrative that the BBC is in very choppy waters at the moment. We've had Nicky Morgan, the Culture Secretary, make a speech this week where she effectively signalled that the licence fee could possibly be scrapped in 2027. Does the BBC face an existential threat, do we think?
I think it does. I mean, the BBC's total income is about £5 billion, of which 75% comes from the licence fee. It's interesting, the £80 million, just quickly on that, because the licence fee goes up by £3 in April, and in fact, that will generate an extra £80 million a year. So it's rather odd it's an £80 million cut in News and Current Affairs.
But it's part of a broader £800 million cut.
Sure,
they're trying to make. We've had the easy savings, I think. That's the other point.
That's what the BBC would say. I mean, I think that £5 billion is not an inconsiderable sum. And what's important is...
loose change.
Yes. I mean, I'm sure it is for you, Jake. But you know, the point is, what is the BBC for? I mean, I think someone needs to actually sit down with a piece of paper again and think, look, if we want to retain some sort of universal charging to every household and not go the Netflix model, not have advertising, not be, you know, funded directly by the government and all the negatives that would produce, we've got to appeal to everybody. We've got to make sure that the BBC somehow touches everybody in whatever way. It doesn't have to be every single service, but online, TV, radio, you know, you've got to get something for everybody and work out what that is and then work out how to spend the £5 billion. The trouble is they're starting from where they are, and what they tend to do is a bit like the Victoria Derbyshire thing. They lob off limbs, you know, rather than thinking, can we do it more efficiently? Let's think about what we're about. The licence fee thing is significant because clearly if it is decriminalised, and I suspect that will be the outcome, that is going to increase the amount of evasion. If you look at the licence fee income 2019-2018, and these are BBC annual report figures, about 900,000 people stopped paying the licence fee in that year. So a very significant drop in income. If that continues, the BBC is heading for a precipice. So I think, you know, whilst cost-cutting is an expedient for the moment, it's not going to solve the problem because they're going to keep cost-cutting until they've killed the BBC. You've got to think about how to make sure the BBC reaches everybody and everyone's willing to pay for it. Because if we're all willing to pay for it and we all think we're getting value, they haven't got a problem.
So this, I mean, this,
and if they can afford to pay for it too. I mean, this is
well, it's about affordability too. I mean, the licence fee is not insignificant.
I am going to wave this little piece of paper at you. This is the Daily Mirror yesterday. British Lifesavers.
We can't have the Daily Mirror. Sorry, it's banned. Sorry. It's not allowed.
Not allowed in here.
Not allowed.
It's to one side, Maggie.
Maggie. Shame on you.
I was reading this with a great delight. I read the FT and the Daily Mirror first thing in the morning. And it's a list, it's a proper sort of piece of research into what Brits think of as lifesavers, what are we about. And it's a list of all different things. But right up there, good and proper, is the BBC. And I read this just as all of this debate was going on about the decriminalisation, which actually I find quite hard to defend the fact that women largely get dragged through the magistrates' courts and all the rest of it. And then get
not
a,
very many, fortunately.
I mean, only five people have gone to prison.
Yes,
in
but it's 121,000 people which are fined, and the majority of those are women. And it was noticeable, really, I thought yesterday, that nobody really in Parliament, because MPs get lobbied on this a lot, was actually saying, opposing Nicky Morgan. There was every opportunity for Tracy Braben, the Labour culture shadow secretary, to make a bit of a show. In fact, she was rather showing off too much of her flesh, according to some people, because she was wearing a rather racy dress in Parliament. But there wasn't a kicking back. The people who were opposing it were, of course, you know, great BBC fans. I mean, myself, really. But I actually think it is a very difficult thing to argue that you have a compulsory licence fee that can turn you into or give you a criminal record.
I mean, ultimately, it's like Netflix. People,
but
actually,
what I was actually trying to
say,
sorry,
they pay for it because they want it. You know, you shouldn't have to make it criminal. You should actually make people want
so
to pay
good.
It. So good, they'll pay for it anyway. That has to be the BBC's call. Sure.
And this is why, the BBC does face a lot of threats. Mm. I think you can underestimate the public's affection for it. And I'm not saying that it's perfect, but given that the centenary, 100 years of the BBC will be in 2022, they'll obviously make a great, great push on that. And on top of that, you can't disrupt a royal charter until 2027. It does give the BBC 7 or 8 years and lots of clever people ways of thinking. And
a new director general.
And a new director general and a new chairman and a new
There's
board.
A lot going on.
There's
I mean, we could talk about the BBC for the whole show, but we're going to talk about a couple of departures from the BBC, both for very different reasons. First of all, is Sarah Sands. If we could just jump on that specifically. Did she see the writing on the wall? Has she jumped ship knowing that the BBC is going under?
Well, I think it's a great shame because I think she's done a really good job and I think it's a great loss to lose Sarah Sands. I mean, the way the cuts were handled seems to be a bit careless. I mean, Victoria Derbyshire, you know, found out in an inappropriate way. Maybe she thought now's the time to go. I think that probably was it. She thought, you know what, I can see the writing on the wall. Let me go and do something else.
So Sarah was the editor of the Today programme.
Absolutely.
Did she do a good job, Maggie? Just briefly?
I think so, except I got rather irritated with some of her rather softer cultural things that sort of happened around about 2009.
I remember you bringing this up
those.
With her at the broadcast.
I liked that.
I didn't.
You want the hard stuff all the time.
No, I mean, I very much liked the item on Shakespeare this morning and children. I mean, that was actually in the 8 to 9 o'clock slot. But there were times when I thought, I've just about had enough of this waffling on and you've cut out somebody who's really interesting. But, you know, that's a minor thing. Look, who wants to get up so early in the morning anyway? She is 59. She's got a very, very strong curriculum vitae now. She could go in and help The Times with its radio shows. They've already recruited some
people. There's an idea.
People. Yes, I mean, she's going to be in demand. And she also she writes very well too. So she's probably just run for the door at the right time.
You heard it here first. We must also say goodbye to Nicholas Parsons, host of the longest running panel show, Just a Minute. He died last week at the age of 96 and was mourned by his legion of fans. Lots of lovely anecdotes about Nicholas, haven't there?
Yes. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because that show was amazing. He also did, of course, the very cheesy Sale of the Century, you know, the Quiz of the Week, live from Norwich. But what I loved, actually, was the quotes, you know, that were thrown everywhere. And, a couple I just pulled out, you know. I loved his line when he said, we are rogues and vagabonds waiting by the phone there to hire for our talents, a bit like prostitutes. And he said, I have a very weak stomach. I'm not sure how I'd handle it with kangaroo testicles. You know, I mean, just a man with humour and grace. And he's sort of, I guess, a bygone age, 47 years on one show. My goodness me.
He was at the Broadcasting Press Guild lunch.
Last year,
which is rather wonderful.
He went out on a good lunch then.
Yes.
I had the honour of passing him the award, which
I thought so, yes.
Was a very special moment. Nice.
What did he say to you? Did he say that afterwards?
He was completely charming. And he spoke for about 20 minutes, had the audience in the palm of his hand. There was great laughter and joy in the room. And I think we all reflect on that as a real moment now that he's passed, unfortunately. Did you come across him while you were in the media reporting trenches?
Not really. I mean, he's somebody who actually kept himself, in a way, away from the media and indeed his personal life too. And I always listened to him and he just had this wonderful deadpan humour, I thought, and the timing was the thing. He didn't try to sort of outshine, and he was so sharp.
Running a panel show is not that easy, you know.
No, you have to respond quickly.
And you've got to be quick, and you've got to keep track of what's going on. And, you know, gosh, at 90-something, he was absolutely on the money, really impressive.
And he could really deliver a blue line as well.
He could.
Your minute's up on Nicholas Parsons.
We're fans.
And we've got barely enough time for the media quiz. This week it's entitled Blast from the Past. I'll name a location synonymous with a media company or event, and you tell me the old thing that reared its head. Everyone clear?
Not really.
Not really.
Of course not. It will become clear. Just buzz in with your name when you know the
answer.
Can
you bring back on?
I'm just a poor shadow.
No, we love you, Jake. We love you. That was a very cheap thing.
So we'll do the buzzer test. Paul, you'll say...
Buzzer. Paul.
And Maggie.
I'll say Maggie.
Okay, let's go. Carlisle Street, Soho, home of Private Eye and a number of post-production houses.
Oh, this is the bomb. Sorry, Paul.
Well done.
This is the unexploded World War II bomb that caused them to evacuate Dean Street and almost risk Private Eye not actually making its deadline.
That's true, and I'm sure there are a lot of grumpy TV producers spilled out on the streets. Okay,
so
congratulations.
Eyes were almost closed.
Yeah, that's...
that's best I could do.
Yeah, that's correct. So 1 point to Paul. Second question. The National Television Award for Best
Maggie.
Comedy...
That was Brown's
Boys. Mrs. Brown's Boys. Yes, that's right. And it beat Flavour of the Decade, Fleabag. Extraordinary.
No, it isn't extraordinary because these are awards that are voted for by people. And look at the ratings of Mrs. Brown's Boys. I mean, even my husband likes it a bit. So he's very fussy. So.
And it's got longevity. You know, it's a brand. I'm not surprised when the public vote. I would, you know.
It's a crash show, but
it's
funny.
Yeah.
Well, it's clearly cherished by its audience and that's what matters, isn't it? So... It's a dead heat and going into our final question. 1-1. So number three, here we go. What's the blast from the past that's going to appear on Channel 4's All 4 this month?
Oh, it's Seinfeld.
Oh, Maggie, I didn't hear a name.
Maggie, yeah. Maggie.
Yes.
Yes, I'm very excited by this.
It is Seinfeld.
This is all part of Channel 4's attempts to really reinvigorate its digital channels.
Get back in touch with the kids.
E4 and All 4. I mean, no, All 4 was a more vintage one, but, you know... you can see what's going on. They're putting lots of efforts into there.
Well, I find it extraordinary that Seinfeld didn't have a home here for the best part of a year. It was on Amazon Prime last year and then kind of disappeared.
Channel 4 have a reputation for being quite nippy when they...
It's very opportunistic, isn't it?
Yes.
It's smart. Smart bit of deal making. And
no,
of course,
it's a cold commercial heart. They have to do the deals to keep going.
They're advertising funded. They have to do this.
Exactly.
So... That means you're the winner, Maggie.
But this
congratulations, Maggie.
Is that your first win?
Yes.
You know, well, I'm honoured to oversee
it. I have to be on before.
Because you've got very weak opposition.
No, you're just an international traveller.
Oh, right.
No, Paul, there's always next time.
I will aspire to win next time.
Thank you so much for both of you for coming on. That's it today. Thanks to my guests, Maggie Brown and Paul Robinson. If you like what we're doing here on the Media Podcast and want to help us keep doing it, then consider taking out a voluntary subscription. Head to themediapodcast.com/donate and choose an amount to keep us all going all year round. You can catch up with previous episodes and get new ones as soon as they're released by subscribing for free at our website, themediapodcast.com. I'm Jake Cantor. The producer was Matt Hill. The Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.